We can take our Bibles, go together to the book of Luke in Luke chapter 16. While you're turning there, just a couple of announcements. This coming Tuesday, we are supposed to have our final inspection for this sanctuary renovation. And nobody says amen louder than I do. Amen. We are ready for that. Our plan right now, Lord willing, is that in 2 weeks, 2 Sundays from now, we'll be facing that side of the auditorium towards our permanent stage, and this will be torn down, which means next Sunday after church, we're going to need some help. So for those of you that can make some plans to stick around a little bit, we got to tear all of this down, move the gear over there, and enable our worship team just a much more efficient and effective means of getting things launched and moved around. So if at all possible next Sunday, if you can make plans to stick around a few minutes afterwards and help us out, that would be great. Also, you drove in and you saw the playground outside. We're going to officially dedicate that playground next Sunday after church. So we'll go out there, we'll have a dedication, then we'll come back in here, and the able-bodied folks will help move chairs and gear. But what an awesome thing. We did not plan on everything coming together at the same time. That's just God's timing. But starting next Sunday, your kids need to bring their short pants and be ready to go after church to play in this playground together, because we are so ready for it. All right, well, Luke chapter 16. Before I get into this, just want to highlight a particular story. And some of you, I think this one will be familiar to you, because I know it's a fairly common story out there. But it's one of the greatest practical jokes that has ever happened on national television. 1961 and the Rose Bowl, between the Washington Huskies and the Caltech Beavers, I think they were. And so they're going up on 100,000 viewers. 100,000 people in the stadium, and then you had who knows how many millions watching this on television. Well, what was going on was, it was the Washington Huskies. They had a group of people up in the stands, and they had these cards, and you've seen this before, and they're going to flip their cards, and when they do so, everyone from a distance will be able to look at the cards and see what they say. And the Caltech students learned about this. So they began to think, how can we do something on this? So they found a way to find one of the cheerleaders, and they found out where the cheerleaders were staying, where the cards were being kept, where the plans were, and so they faked being news reporters to get all this information out. They lied to the cheerleaders, and then as a result, they made this discovery. Then they broke into the cheerleaders' hotel room when they weren't there, got a hold of the cards, got a hold of the grand master plan as to how the cards were going to be arranged, and then they left with a copy of the master plan. Broke into the hotel room again later on, and they came back with some additional cards to put in the stack of cards that all these students were going to be holding. So as a result, it's game day, and the cheerleaders are giving everyone their cue, and there's like 14 different things that are either going to be written or pictures or images that are going to be presented that day, and 11 of them went just great. But then on the 12th one, the students stood, and they flipped the cards, and there was an image of the Caltech mascot, a beaver. And they thought, that's kind of unusual that Washington would put the other team's mascot up there. So they put that down. Nobody really said much about it. And then the 12th image came up. And this time, it was the name Washington, but it was spelled backwards. So when the crowd looked, it looked like Washington didn't know what they were doing. And then finally, on the 14th and on the last one, it was time to flip the cards, and they did. And when they did, right in front of thousands of viewers was the word Caltech. And there was this hushed silence over the entire crowd. And then afterwards, they just erupted into laughter over this event. It was one of the greatest practical jokes ever pulled off. But I want you to stop and consider something. In order for this to happen, lying occurred, deception occurred, breaking and entering, which is breaking the law, all occurred. And had those guys been caught, they very well would have been arrested, and they could very well have been expelled. And I thought about that, and I thought, you know, if my son went to Caltech, and he pulled something like this off, but he got caught, and then he was arrested, and he lost he was kicked out of the school altogether, I would look him in the eye, and I would say, son, I have never been more proud of you than I am at this moment. Because of the brilliance that you had in getting a team of people together and pulling something like this off. And the fact of the matter is, a number of the folks that did pull this off went off to be CEOs of company. One of them became an astronaut later on. And another one was sort of the lead project manager at one of the primary jet propulsion labs here in the nation. So it's a brilliant astuteness, but it's shown through a kind of a dark example. And that's going to be our text for today, because our text is going to do the exact same thing. We're going through a series. I've called it Becoming a Significant Christian. And I just want to remind you, when I say this, I don't mean significant in your eyes or trying to be a significant Christian in the eyes of other people around you. But how can I be significant for God's purposes, that I would be fully used of Him and be able to accomplish that which He would want me to accomplish? And so for many of the things that we've been looking at so far, for a number of you, you would look and you go, Jack, we've heard this before. You're reminding us of things we already know. And to that, I would say, great, I'm in good company. Because the Apostle Peter writes in 2 Peter chapter 1, I write these things to stir you up by way of reminder. So it's good for us at times to be reminded of certain truths. And today, we're looking at money. And how significant Christians will view their money with an eternal investment mindset. And Jesus, being just the masterful storyteller, taught a great lesson using a dark story here in Luke chapter 16. It's one of the most difficult ones for people to fully understand and interpret correctly. And it is easy to misinterpret what is actually being exalted and what's being praised by Christ. But we're going to look at it together. Due to time, normally we stand. I'm not going to stand and read the text through. We're just going to kind of go through it together for the next several verses. So we begin here in verse 1. And it says, now he, meaning Jesus, was also saying to the disciples. So note that. This is a message for the followers of Christ. Now, in other places in the text, we know that the Pharisees are listening on. And Luke makes a point to say that the Pharisees, they loved money. They loved what the power and the prestige that came with it. But they are the ricochet on this lesson. It's intended to be for disciples and thus for all of us as well. And Jesus' story goes like this. There was a rich man who had a manager, and this manager was reported to him as squandering his possessions. Now, that word squandering, it's the exact same one used of the prodigal in chapter 15, verse 13, who squandered his estate with loose living. And so this manager, it isn't that he's in over his head. It isn't that, you know, some weird circumstances came on him. Rather, he has been careless. He hasn't been worried. He hasn't concerned himself at all with the funds of his master. And he's just allowed them to go down the drain. And all of a sudden, he's being called to account. Verse 2, it says that his master called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an accounting of your management, for you can no longer be manager. In other words, I'm calling an audit on you. We're going to bring out the books, and we're going to see how things have actually worked out. Now, whenever any of us hear audit, all of us get a sense of dread. Amen? Because there's a sense of, oh, first it's going to be a lot of work, it's probably going to be expensive, and then on top of that, what if there are things that I don't know about that get discovered in this? That's not this guy. He knows there's going to be things that are going to be outed about him. So he's concerned about it. Verse 3, the manager said to himself, oh, what shall I do? Since my master is taking the management away from me, I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. So you see, this guy's primary tools here for his employment are a desk and a computer. He's used to having air conditioning and having a business account that he can take people out to lunch, and he doesn't have to worry about how much he spends on this meal for himself and for others. And now he's facing a life in which he's going to be carrying a shovel and a reflective vest and working for an hourly wage, and it's not what he's used to doing. And so he says, this is going to be a step back for me. And I know all of us have heard the expression, necessity is the mother of invention. When your back is against the wall like this guy's is, you get real creative and you do so really quickly. And so the squandering manager is about to get real astute and very crafty. Verse 4, he says, aha, I know what I shall do, so that when I am removed from the management, people will welcome me into their homes. And he summoned each one of his master's debtors, and he began saying to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, well, take your bill, sit down quickly. Underline that word. Sit down quickly and write 50. And then he said to another, and how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill and write 80. Now, notice the urgency that this guy has, because he knows time is precious. And before I'm outed, I've got to take these measures because I've just got to move fast. And so to fully understand, I think, exactly what's going on here, it also helps us to understand a little bit about the Jewish mindset in business with other Jews at the time. Now, if you'll go back in your Old Testament, you'll find one of the things that a Jew wasn't supposed to do is charge interest from his brother or sister. If you're going to give a loan, you do the loan, but you don't charge interest on top of it. But at the time, a lot of the religious leaders reinterpreted that to mean, you know, yeah, it says don't charge interest, but what it really means is don't charge interest for those who are really poor, but you can charge interest from everybody else. And it kind of became somewhat of a practice that many people would do and would use, but you kind of kept it under the radar, so to speak. So most people, when they're paying back their loans, are going to do so with a sense of interest. And so this manager saw what his boss was owed by others, and he decides, here's what I'm going to do. We're going to eliminate the interest payment. But he had to act quickly before the audit kicked in. So he's protecting his future. He's not actually stealing from his master, but he is cheating his master out of funds that were supposed to be coming his way through these interest payments. And that explains why we get his master making a summary about him in verse 8 when he says, his master praised the unrighteous manager. The manager is using his master's resources in a very clever way in order to establish and to fix his own position in the community. It's because he's cheated his master that we've called this the parable of the unrighteous steward. He's betrayed the trust that he had by his master over his possessions. But in these circumstances, he has most definitely acted shrewdly. I liken it to a Washington Husky going up to a Caltech person and giving a little salute and saying, well played, my friend. You embarrassed us, but well played. That was amazing. And that's the lesson Jesus wants us to learn in this example. He writes in verse 8, for the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. You've got these people, they've now been freed from these original bond payment, or at least the interest on the bond payment. And now the owner, he can't take this guy to claims court and saying, hey, I'm supposed to get this interest back, because it makes him look bad. Makes him look bad with the people that he's done the business with, and it makes him look bad in the community. So you see the brilliance, really, behind the manager's way of thinking. He's cheating his master, and he effectively closes any legal action his master might be tempted to bring against him, because it would just make the master look bad, and he would be seen as greedy. So this guy's astuteness, his brilliance, has kept him out of the poorhouse. His reputation among businesses has been elevated. He's the guy who helps small businesses along. That's the way he'll be seen. He's forgiving their interest to help them succeed. And he comes away looking selfless and great. And his master can't say one word about it in the community. And now, this guy, when he gets let go, is going to be able to go out and is going to get, everybody's going to want him and want to hire him. Because they go, you are great. You are an awesome guy. We want to have you as part of our business. Now, once again, Jesus is not endorsing this man's actions of cheating his master. Rather, he commends the man's cleverness, that he's taking this finances, this money and resources, and he's taking a bad situation and he's reversing it to turn a great thing and make a great thing happen out of it. And it's here that Jesus then challenges his followers. He's basically saying, now you be that clever. You be that crafty when it comes to thinking and planning your use of money on this limited time you have on earth. Quickly Remember I told you to underline that? You've got a limited time. Quickly think, how will you take these resources and use them for God's purposes? The big idea being significant Christians use their money with eternity in mind. It isn't merely today and this week. There is a long-term strategy. How can we use this for God's purposes? And it's at this point, Jesus takes everything, and I don't have to figure out the application, but he goes right into the application. And he gives three ways, and the first one is found here in verse 9, where Jesus says, "And I say to you, you make friends for yourselves by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will receive you into the eternal dwellings." The first call, you be intentionally strategic with the money and consider how this is going to affect eternal souls. Because one day, you're going to die, and your money will not go with you. It is still going to be here. Jesus' challenge, who are you going to see in heaven because of the way you invested your finances today and how you spent your money? True story. We had a congregant who got a call from somebody, and it was a relative, and they said, my wife and I were getting a divorce, and it broke this person's heart. And so as they got to talking with them, they said, "Okay, I tell you what, before you file for divorce, can I give you a challenge? Where you live, there's this thing called Family Life Conference, and they do a lot of help with marriages. So before you go down this path, why don't you go to that, and I'll pay for it. I'll pay for the conference. I'll pay for the hotel room. I'll pay for your food. I've got it covered. All you have to do is go." And they went, and they got saved. They became believers at this. And then because they became Christians, then they began to reassess their own marriage and what God would do in their lives. And it happened because somebody said, "I got three $100 bills. I'll drop them on you." And they did so. We've got a playground right out here. We haven't dropped $100,000 on it, but we're coming close. Now, you need to know something. We're not doing this so we can have our playground. That's not the intent and the goal. Yes, we will use it, and yes, we want to see our children be blessed by it, but we want this to also be something that people in the community can come and can use. Now, before we even did this, we still had people occasionally swinging by in the community, and I would see them out here with their kids, and they would play on the playground, and, you know, every once in a while, it would open up an opportunity to go out and talk with somebody. But Steven Jesberger's out here doing some work on it here in the last couple of weeks, and a guy shows up with his kid, and Steven's talking with him. He's like, "Hey, when this thing's done, you bring your kid over here, and y'all play on this thing." And then he began to talk about, we're a church, and we care about people, and we want this to be open to the community. And it just begins to open things up to a spiritual dimension with an individual who's just looking for a place for their kid to play. But these are the kinds of things that we can do. So by investing money in something like this, what kind of door does it open later on? Jesus's challenge is, when you get to heaven, who's going to look at you and go, "Thank you. Thank you because you dropped some money on this and God used it to then impact me in a way that brought me here. Thank you." And I've seen this before within this congregation. Somebody needed rent. Another person came and said, "I got your rent. We're going to take care of you." Why would you do that? Because we're Christians. God calls us to love our neighbor. And so we're going to help you and see you through this issue and this problem that you've got. I've seen this before with transportation. People who didn't have transportation. Someone says, "I got you covered. I'm going to get you a car. We're going to buy you a car." That has happened before, to give you the transportation. Why would you ever do something like that? And you see how this begins to open the door for conversations. We have paid for people to go to counseling. And as a result, the impact Christian counseling is where we want to send them, so that they begin to get help in the relationship as well as Christ within the message. Because at the end of the day, that's the only thing that's really going to help them, is Christ. You've heard about this whole relational wisdom and this seminar that we're going to have, and it's designed for non-Christians to come. Ideally, for you to invite someone that you know has relational problems with other folks, and you come with them. That's costing us several $1,000s to make happen. Why? because we see this as an opportunity to minister and to bless those that are have cratered relationships. And at the same time, what kind of door will this open for us to be able to point them to the ultimate rescuer and savior and healer, Jesus Christ? But it takes money. Others of you, you have helped pay for an adoption to bring a child into a home where the child is then going to hear and see the gospel lived out for the duration of that child's life. And potentially, who knows, bring that person into the faith. My friend, when you get to heaven, you won't even think about the money, not one bit. You will only see the people, and you will be so grateful that God saw fit somehow to use you in this plan of bringing them here, and in some cases, with the money that you spent. How much is it worth risking for a soul? There's a second application that Jesus brings to us here. It's in verse 10. He says, "He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. And he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. And therefore, if you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, who will entrust the true riches to you? And if you've not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own?" The idea here, we're not only to be intentionally strategic with the money that we have, but we're to faithfully use that money for God's purposes. God is telling us that the purchases that we make, that ultimately our view of money is a barometer, really, of where our hearts are to the Lord. And that has nothing to do with how much money you have. Whether you have a lot of money or you have just a little bit of money, it's always going to be a barometric measurement of how you view God. You can't get away from that. And so here's the question. When God gives you resources, are you faithful with them? Are you faithful with them? Can I personalize this a little bit on the negative side? Debt. Are you in a lot of debt? Here's what happens when that occurs. You are not free to serve. You have a new master, and that is you got to pay off the debt. And so you're not free to serve. And on top of that, you're not really free to give either. So if you do discover a financial need that someone has, you've already had the obligation, the commitment that it's going to somebody else in the terms of interest payments. And so I'm not speaking about every once in a while, will someone get in a situation because of a severe health emergency or, I don't know, you get sued, wrongly sued or whatever. Sometimes those kinds of things happen. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about our eyes got bigger than our stomach, so to speak. We saw more of what we'd like to consume than what we could actually consume. And the call, you need to be disciplined in your purchases. You need to be wise in your spending and think it through. It means you need a budget. If you don't have a budget, you need to start making one. And then within your budget, what you got to do, which I'll talk about in a minute, not only do you want to give to the Lord, but you are wise to set up a separate giving fund. And what that is just money you put aside. And then you discover a need. You just pull from that fund. And now you'll know what I mean when I say this. You don't even have to pray about it. You know, it's kind of like they have the need. We have the money. We can give it right now. And you can do that. But you got to be wise with it. And don't sell yourself out into servitude unto debt. Jesus' point, it's really an argument from the lesser to the greater. If you can't bench 50 pounds, what makes you think you're going to be able to bench 300 pounds? If you can't handle the income and the money God has given you here, what makes you think you're going to be able to handle the souls that God's going to entrust to you in this life, in your home, in your church? How do you do that? You got to be free from the love of the material goods, but you got to be deliberate. You got to be intentional, and you got to be faithful with the funds that God has given you. Now, by my saying this, all of a sudden you feel condemned and your eyes just want to go to the floor. Can I just be real candid with you? Don't do it. Don't do it. Rather than sit around and being discouraged, instead, be challenged. Be challenged. This is your opportunity to see God work and Him be faithful as you become faithful and you begin moving in this direction. And so now is the time to say, Lord, by your grace, I'm going to seek to become shrewd with your resources. and use them in the way you want for your will and for your kingdom. And I'll make you a promise. He will show himself faithful. As you are faithful, you're going to see it. And so you might need to get some accountability, get some regarding your spending lifestyle, and be ready to make changes so that you can be faithful. And that then leads us to the third implication. We're not only to be intentionally strategic with the resources that God has given us, and not only to be faithful with it, but also we got to know that money is a great servant, but it is a terrible master. You cannot make an idol out of money. Verse 13, Jesus says, no servant can serve two masters. Either he'll hate the one and he'll love the other, or else he'll be devoted to one and despise the other, but you cannot serve God and wealth. You can't let it do that. And one of the ways God has instituted with us that build us to help us in this, at the end of the day, winds up being our giving in and through the local church. Because what I'm doing is, it's just like the Jew in the Old Testament. God said, give of the first fruits of your wealth. You take right off the top. But God, what if we don't have enough for later? God says, that's where you get to trust me. And now you're cultivating a mindset that says, I'm not going to trust in what I can build up. I'm going to trust God. And so you give off the top of what God has given to you. You know, when our kids were really young, I'm going to really date myself here. We gave them an allowance, and it was $1 a week. And what I did was I divided it up for them. I was like, okay, 50 cents. You're going to keep and you're going to spend, all right? 40 cents, I want to encourage you to save. But here's 10 cents, and I want you to take that, and we're going to give it to church. So every Sunday morning, I gave them their allowance, and I went and I got my dime. I was like, here's your dime. This is your giving. And one of my sons, without fail, every single Sunday morning, as soon as we got out of the car, Daddy, I lost my giving. Every single week. A dime never made it out of that car between our house then in Leesburg and when we showed up on the church property. And probably reveals a lot about me too that I just didn't pick up on that when that happened about 52 times in a row. Here's my challenge. As adults, we usually don't lose it in the car on the way to church. We lose it in things like streaming services that we may not even be using. We'll lose it on eating out when we didn't have to eat out. We just chose to. Amazon purchases for things that, frankly, we really don't need, and we just kind of got into when we saw it on the phone or on the television. Another one, kids' sports can absolutely drain your bank account. But when we look at God and we have all those things and we say, God, I lost my giving. He looks and he goes, really? Really? You lost it? Or have you not been stewarding it? I've called you to steward it. This is why whenever I do discipleship, whenever we do premarital counseling, whenever we have a newcomer's class, I talk about this. And I've gotten over people thinking, well, you got an ulterior motive, you know, whatever, because you're a pastor and trying to get money for the church. I've completely gotten over that. Because anytime I can go to a passage of scripture and I can say, how do you deal with this? Then it becomes really clear, this isn't about me. God has always provided for this church, and he will continue to do so. The question is, what are you doing with the resources that God has given you? And are you wise with them? It's one of the first places for us to demonstrate its role for us and where this money is in our hearts. That will we intentionally go to it, take those resources and use it for God's causes and be faithful with it right off the top. Or, God, I lost my giving. It's somewhere in all this other stuff that I spent it. Next week, we have what we call first fruits. And it's at that time we've just purposed the first Sunday of every month to draw attention to it. Mainly, it isn't so much that people will give. It's mainly so that those who give automatically won't give mindlessly. Because that's the other side of this whole thing, is if I just have it automatically deducted from my paycheck and give to God right off the top, but I don't even think about it, then before long, it loses its act of worship. And so we've purposed to set that particular Sunday up to highlight that component and that aspect. But where are you when it comes to money? What kind of consideration do you give it in your life, and in your spiritual walk. Couple of weeks, we're going to be out here. We're going to have our church vote. And when we do, we're voting on our budget. And in voting on our budget, we're saying this is where our income is, or our giving is going to be allocated. We predetermined we're going to spend it on various aspects, whether it has to do with how we utilize and use our building, whether it has to do with the missionaries that we send, the staff that we are supporting who help keep the ministry moving forward. All these things, you'll see them. We're out front. But it only happens when believers are deliberate to say, God, take my resources and use them to further your kingdom. Because Jesus says, you cannot, not you might not, you cannot serve God and money. So where is it in your heart? The call, you be astute. You be clever. You be shrewd. Live in such a way that God will tip his hat to you and say, well played. Well played. That was brilliant.